You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The French Revolution set Europe ablaze. It was an age of enlightenment and progress, but also of tyranny and oppression. It was an age of glory and an age of tragedy. One man stood above it all. This was the age of Napoleon. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. Join me as I examine the life and times of one of the most fascinating and enigmatic characters in modern history. Look for The Age of Napoleon wherever you find your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers podcast. This is part four in our series on French explorer Jules Dumont d'Urville. Two notes. First, if you are so inclined, go to explorerspodcast.com to see a map of today's journey. And second, in the show notes, as well as on the website, there is a link to our giveaway of the book, Daring French Explorations. Heck, you can just go there to see the cool photos. But at the same time, you can sign up for our free drawing of the book. And that, my friends, are today's notes. On with the story of Jules Dumont d'Urville. Last time, we finished with d'Urville and the Astrolabe sailing away from the Tongan Islands in May of 1827. The visit to the island had nearly ended in disaster in more ways than one. The ship had been pulled onto a reef multiple times, causing the Astrolabe to lose several anchors and mooring cables. And then nine men had been kidnapped by the Tongans, which had led to a three-day standoff, with the French bombarding a Tongan religious site. One man, Corporal Francois Richard, had been killed in the fighting. A couple of other men had ended up deserting. Thankfully, the rest of the men were released and the Astrolabe departed the island. All in all, d'Urville had been lucky. Things could have been much worse. So d'Urville and the Astrolabe were heading towards Fiji, about 500 miles or 800 kilometers to the west of Tonga. The officers and crew of the ship were weary after more than a year at sea. Illness was common, and d'Urville's leadership had not been the most inspiring. There had been bouts of indecisiveness, as well as episodes of depression. And we can't forget that he was known as a brusque and direct man, which could come across as rude and arrogant. He just wasn't the most cuddly guy in the world. The Astrolabe reached the island of Angaulevu, southeast of Fiji, on May 24, 1827. A canoe approached the ship carrying four Tongans, plus a man named Mediola, a native of the island of Guam. Mediola had been on a Spanish ship, the Concepcion, that had been shipwrecked on the island of Lacaba. He told d'Urville that there was an anchor on the island, left over from an old whaling ship. This interested d'Urville, as his ship had lost most of their anchors in Tonga Tepu. D'Urville would go to Lacaba, about 70 miles or 110 kilometers to the north. Unfortunately, the natives were decidedly hostile to the French and didn't want to give up the prized anchor. Thus, the vessel continued on to Fiji, but not before adding three new crewmen. These were Spanish sailors, also survivors of the Concepcion, and they joined the French ship, able replacements for those d'Urville had lost in Tonga. The Astrolabe continued on to Fiji, but d'Urville would never land. There were too many storms, and he was skittish about the island's many reefs. With hardly any of his anchors or cables, he understood that going close to the shore was risky business. The Astrolabe would spend 18 days zigzagging through and mapping the Fiji archipelago. The ship never stopped to explore the islands, it was just too dangerous. But they did trade with the natives, acquiring pigs, chickens, yams, coconuts, and other items. Next, it was on to the Loyalty Islands, followed by the large islands north of New Guinea, which included New Ireland. There, the ship was caught in a storm and a mooring cable snapped. Another anchor was thus lost. Still, the ship came into Lamassa Bay, where the men collected food and water, while the scientists went out and gathered specimens. This meant that there were many more great additions to the expedition's collection, including the Bismarck Hawk Owl, a.k.a. the New Ireland Boo Book. D'Urville really wanted a crocodile, but he would have to settle for the head of one. Of the natives, d'Urville had little good to say. He called them stupid, indolent, apathetic, dirty, and hideous. On New Ireland, d'Urville would develop enteritis, an inflammation of the small intestine, probably the result of an infection. The prescribed treatment of leeches and enemas did him no favors. D'Urville felt so bad, he worried he might not recover. He even wrote that he was suffering from a, quote, dullness of the mind and a general indisposition, end quote. The truth is that D'Urville was getting old, fast. He was only 37, but life in the Navy was not always easy. Years of bad diet, gout, exhaustion, and stress were catching up to him. This was a tough thing for a man who had always been so robust and active. Because of all of this, he drafted a letter for his second-in-command, Charles Jacquinot, detailing to him how to conduct the rest of the expedition, just in case he died. But D'Urville would gradually get better, and on July 17th, the Astrolabe would set sail, cruising along the northern coast of New Guinea. Along the way, D'Urville would name some places. This included Astrolabe Bay, Cape Quasi, Humboldt Bay, and Cape D'Urville. In August, the Astrolabe would pass through the Dampier Strait, twice striking reefs. Thankfully, the damage was minor and the ship never got lodged on either reef. The ship reached Mano Quarry on the Doberai Peninsula, which is the chunk of land that makes up the westernmost area of New Guinea. This was the same place that Coquille had visited several years earlier. D'Urville and the naturalists conducted botanical excursions while water and timber were collected. D'Urville noted that the efforts tired him out. He wrote it was, quote, a kind of general languor, a weakness in all parts of my body that made me lose the taste for the long excursions, end quote. One of the shore parties was attacked by the natives, a man shot in the back with an arrow. He was okay, but D'Urville was eager to move on, anxious to avoid any sort of fight. The Astrolabe sailed off on September 6th. The expedition next moved into the Banda Sea and reached the port of Ambon on September 24th, D'Urville handing over his letters of introduction to the Dutch governor. Ambon was familiar to D'Urville, as the Coquille had been here on his previous journey. Now, a few points to discuss. First, the Dutch would be tremendously helpful. They were able to reprovision the ship with food, including rice and biscuits, but more importantly, they had anchors and cables, which the Astrolabe desperately needed. These were critical for continuing the expedition. Second, the crew did lose several men. This included Kokeko, the Maori sailor who had joined the Astrolabe in New Zealand. Also, two of the Spanish sailors who had been rescued near Fiji left the ship. And third, D'Urville would announce to the crew that he was raising wages for everyone. He also announced some promotions which would not become official until approved by the Naval Ministry. No doubt everyone appreciated the gestures. As for D'Urville, he would recover his health and visit the Chinese court of the city and even attend a Chinese wedding. The Astrolabe departed Ambon, their destination Australia, and then back to New Zealand. The plan was to sail down the western coast of Australia and again go along the underside of the continent. This time the ship would go to Tasmania before heading back to New Zealand. This route would allow D'Urville to check out the western coast of Australia, and the return to New Zealand would allow him to more closely investigate the island's coastline. He had done a lot on the previous visit, but he had barely surveyed any of the South Island. And so off went the Astrolabe. The voyage down the western side of Australia was uneventful. The French checked out some areas, but strong winds drove the Astrolabe out to sea for much of the journey south. Thus, no major surveys were conducted of the western coast. Perhaps D'Urville understood that it was futile to spend time here, as the British had plans for the area. No point in surveying a location that you knew never could be settled. Anyhow, the Astrolabe would sail down the Australian coast and then head west, staying well clear of the continent. On December 17, 1827, they reached the southern tip of Tasmania, then known as Van Diemen's Land. The Astrolabe sailed into the small port of Hobart, the first French ship to ever do so. So, as I mentioned, D'Urville's plan was to go from Tasmania to New Zealand, but it was here that news reached him that would alter his plans. Word had spread that an Irish captain, Peter Dillon, had discovered the location of the lost expedition of Jean-François de Galoup-La Pérouse. Let us recap this story. In 1785, La Pérouse had departed France on an expedition of discovery. It was an epic voyage, La Pérouse going to South America, Hawaii, Alaska, California, Japan, Russia, and Australia. But in early 1788, La Pérouse left Australia, bound for the area of New Caledonia and the Solomon Islands. He and his crew were never seen again. A rescue mission was sent, but nothing found. For decades, the French nation pondered the fate of La Pérouse and his men. Now, I had mentioned that before D'Urville had departed on his voyage, a report had reached France related to La Pérouse. Here are those details. In 1825, a Royal Navy captain named Thomas Manby had encountered some natives on a small island between New Caledonia and New Guinea. These men had items indicating they were French in origin. This included a sword with the word Paris engraved on it, and medals depicting King Louis XVI were found as well. Also, one of the natives, who was about 50 years old, said that as a youth on his island, a large ship had been wrecked on a coral reef in a storm. Could this have been La Perouse? With that in mind, D'Urville had been given orders to keep a lookout for any sort of information about the lost expedition. And here in Hobart, he got such information in the form of Peter Dillon. 6 months earlier, Dillon had been in Hobart, and he told the story of finding artifacts of a French ship on an island in the Pacific. Let me back up and tell that story. Dillon was born in Martinique in the Caribbean, the son of Irish parents. He was 39 years old and had been sailing the waters of Asia and the South Pacific for decades. He was based out of Calcutta, India. In 1826, Dillon had been sailing his ship, the St. Patrick, from South America to India, with stops in Tahiti and New Zealand. It was then that his ship was hit by a big storm and began to take on water. On May 13, 1826, as he worked his way back to India, he stopped at the island of Tokopia, about 1,600 miles or 2,600 kilometers north of New Zealand. It is the furthest east of the Solomon Islands and a couple of hundred miles north of Vanuatu. Here, Dillon found the islanders possessed numerous items of French origin. This included sword guards, teacups, knives, and glass beads. Dillon questioned the natives, who said the items had come from two shipwrecks off the island of Vanikoro to the west. He was convinced these had come from the ships of La Perouse. Dillon wanted to go investigate, but foul winds and a leaking ship prevented him from doing so. Instead, he headed back to India, reaching it on August 30, 1826, where he wrote up a report about what he had found and offered to lead an expedition to Vanikoro to follow up on the information. The British East India Company would agree, giving him a small survey vessel, the Research. He was even ordered to meet with D'Urville if the opportunity arose, as the British knew the French were in the region. Dillon took his ship under the Australian continent, just like D'Urville, and arrived in Hobart on April 5, 1827, 6 months before D'Urville. Now, Dillon ended up clashing with the surgeon of the Research, and he was even fined for his role in that clash, but he was eventually able to sail on, intent on reaching Vanikoro. And that takes us up to December 1827, as the Astrolabe arrived in Hobart. It was here that D'Urville would get the details of Dillon's story from a sailor who had been on the St. Patrick when it had stopped in Tikopia. And then a newspaper arrived from Sydney with a report that Dillon had found artifacts from the La Perouse expedition. This included cannons, kitchen utensils, a ship's bell, and more. Now, this was all very interesting, but there was one big problem. Very few people actually trusted Peter Dillon. Officials in Hobart said he was a charlatan. They didn't trust what he said. And even if he was telling the truth, they didn't trust what he'd actually found was the wreckage of La Perouse's ship. D'Urville now had a decision to make. To find evidence of La Perouse's expedition would be a great feather in his cap. His officers, however, told D'Urville that he was nuts to go chasing after the ghost of La Perouse, especially since Dillon may have already beaten him to the prize. Was it worth it to be second in such a race? But the idea was too much for D'Urville. At worst, he would confirm Dillon's story. At best, he would demonstrate that Dillon was wrong, and he could claim the title of finding out the fate of La Perouse's expedition. And so the Astrolabe would stay 15 days in Hobart, adding provisions and supplies, as well as botanizing the area. D'Urville even felt healthy enough to climb to the top of nearby Mount Wellington, which had an altitude of more than 4,000 feet, or 1,300 meters. The Astrolabe departed the port on January 5, 1828. One crewman would be left in Hobart after he suffered a mental breakdown. The ship sailed into the Tasman Sea, but instead of heading west to New Zealand, she veered north. The destination was Vanikoro, the possible resting place of La Perouse and his long-lost expedition. Guys, I just heard something mind-blowing. Okay, so you know that when you search for something on Netflix, what you get is only a fraction of what Netflix actually has. Netflix actually has more than 18,000 titles globally, but only like 6,000 of those shows are available in the U.S. You're missing out on literally thousands of great shows unless you use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that lets you change your online location so you can control where you want Netflix to think you're located. They have over 100 different locations so you can gain access to thousands of new shows no matter where you live. This works with other streaming services as well. This allowed me to watch certain seasons of Brooklyn Nine-Nine through Canada and Friends on UK Netflix, which was appropriate because I was able to watch the episode set in England where Monica and Chandler get together. All I had to do was open ExpressVPN, select Great Britain, tap one button to connect, and refresh Netflix. Done. Easy peasy. ExpressVPN is super fast. It's all HD and no buffering, and it works on a bunch of different devices. The other great benefit is that it encrypts your data, which means it improves your privacy and security, keeping you safe while online. So stop missing out on great TV and get thousands of new shows with ExpressVPN. We got them to give you guys 3 extra months free when you use our special link, expressvpn.com/explorers. That's expressvpn.com/explorers to get 3 extra months completely free. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. The Astrolabe arrived at the island of Tikopia about 4 weeks later on February 10, 1828. Derville wanted to come here to confirm the story told by Peter Dillon. The island was small and had a population of about 1,000 Polynesians. Several Europeans lived on the island, including a Prussian named Martin Burkhardt and a few Englishmen, deserters from a whaling boat. But the most fascinating person was a man from Calcutta named Alchalia. He was covered in tattoos like the islanders, and he dressed like the locals. He was barely distinguishable from the native population. The French met with all of these people and confirmed many of the details that Dillon had related to the authorities in India. Alchalia gave Derville directions to Vanikoro, but declined an offer to lead the French to the island. After trading for some fish and coconuts, Derville and the Astrolabe continued on their mission, the island of Vanikoro next on their agenda. The ship would, however, take on some of the deserters from the whaling boat. Two Englishmen, named Hambleton and Williams, joined up. Derville was convinced they were actually convicts who had escaped from Australia. No problem. He felt their knowledge of the local language would be valuable, and he welcomed them on board. The Astrolabe would sail west for several days, and on February 14th, the island of Vanikoro was sighted. Vanikoro is actually a collection of 5 islands, only 2 of which were inhabited at this time. The 5 islands, rugged and heavily forested, were surrounded by a great reef. Derville sent his boats out to explore, while the native people came out in their canoes to trade. It was here the French would learn several important things. First, Peter Dillon and his ship, the Research, had been here 6 months earlier. I don't doubt that the news disappointed Derville, who would have loved to have been the first person to actually find the wreckage of La Perouse's expedition, but there was not much he could do about it now. Second, from a local chief named Nilo, who came out to the ship, Derville was told the story of a vessel being wrecked on the other side of the island some 40 years earlier. Nilo said the French had fired on the locals when they had approached, killing 20 islanders. These men would ultimately be killed by the natives. Third, Derville would find out that Dillon had been very generous with his gifts to the local people. This meant that they were not particularly interested in the usual stuff offered by the French. While this was frustrating, as adding food and provisions was always important, it did discourage any of his crew from deserting, as they couldn't easily buy sexual favors from the islanders. Fourth, the French found that the local people were skittish. They often fled when a boat landed or they were approached. They did, however, get a few stories from some of these people, confirming the idea that one or both of the ships had been wrecked on the island. Derville suspected the islanders were nervous about the French because they feared some sort of reprisals for the deaths of their countrymen 40 years earlier. The Astrolabe would make its way carefully around the island, Victor Charles Lotin sounding a route through the channel between the 2 largest islands, and the boats would be set out to look for evidence of La Perouse. Eventually, Charles Jacquinot would encounter a group of natives who said they knew nothing about the shipwrecks, but sensing they were hiding something, Jacquinot brought out a large length of red cloth, something the islanders highly valued and was hard to get their hands on. This caused one of the men to break, and he took the French to a spot on the shore. There they could see the remains of a ship, including coral-encrusted anchors, cannons, and cannonballs. The French did not know it, but this was the Astrolabe, the vessel for whom Derville's ship had been named after. There was, however, little doubt that this was the remains of one of La Perouse's ships. So as the men of the Astrolabe dove and dragged the wreck site, more details about La Perouse's fate would emerge as the French were visited by other natives. 2 elderly islanders would recount the events from decades earlier. They said that both of La Perouse's ships, the Astrolabe and the Beau Soule, had been wrecked in a big storm. The Bosul had struck the outer reef that ringed Vanikoro, and the men had evacuated to the island. Many of these men were massacred, but some survived. Meanwhile, the Astrolabe had been driven ashore, and when the locals tried to loot the wreck, the fighting began. Upwards of 20 natives, including three chiefs, were killed. The islanders responded with bow and arrow fire, eventually killing the French crew. Over the next 9 months, the survivors of the Bosul then built a two-masted boat out of the wreckage of the Astrolabe. Once done, the survivors sailed off to the west. What happened to them, no one knows. D'Urville, by the way, would blame the islanders for the violence that had occurred. His words were mostly racial in nature. This line in particular demonstrates his attitude. Quote, "As a whole, like all of those of the black race of Oceania, these people are disgusting, lazy, stupid, savage, avaricious, and with neither qualities nor virtues that I know of." End quote. D'Urville saw La Perouse as a great man who had been taken advantage of by the greedy locals. Anyhow, while the French salvaged the wreckage, the Astrolabe's small boats would sail off, doing an extensive survey of the five islands. Also, the naturalists would head into the island's jungles, ultimately collecting more than 230 specimens, including 34 beetles new to science. From the site of La Perouse's Astrolabe, the French would ultimately pull up an anchor, a cannon, a blunderbuss, some porcelain fragments, a kettle, and other tidbits. At the same time all of these things were happening, a contingent of men built a memorial to La Perouse. It was 6 feet high, or 1.8 meters, and made of timber. The foundation was made of coral blocks. No nails or metal was used in the construction, as such items would only get removed by the natives. On March 14th, the memorial was dedicated. Charles Jacquinot led the ceremony, as D'Urville was suffering from a bad fever. There's a nice painting of the ceremony, if inaccurate, which I have linked to on our website. The French would warn the local people that if the monument was desecrated, there would be severe reprisals. So it was mid-March 1828. D'Urville had found the answer to one of France's great naval mysteries, the fate of the La Perouse expedition. While that was cause for celebration, things were not going well for the French. Over the past weeks, illness had crept onto the ship, and not just any illness, but malaria. By March 16th, 40 of the men had a fever. With his crew sick and tired and homesick, D'Urville decided it was time to head back to France. He knew that he was vulnerable to the natives if they should decide to take advantage of the sickness running through the French ranks. But before we head off, I do want to do a little wrap-up about the La Perouse expedition. Captain Peter Dillon had, indeed, found the wreckage of the expedition, and he is the person credited with that feat. Like D'Urville, Dillon had pieced together the fates of the two ships and collected some items from the Astrolabe's wreckage, including the ship's bell. He returned to Europe and met with the lone survivor of La Perouse's expedition, Barthélemy de Lesseps. The man had served as a Russian interpreter and had left the expedition in Siberia and traveled back to Europe overland. Lesseps positively identified the items Dillon had brought back with him as being from the Astrolabe. Dillon would write a book about his experiences and receive a knighthood and pension from the French government for what he had done. Final note, the exact location of the Bosul was not found until 1964. A formal identification would not take place until 2005. So that is the conclusion of the fate of the La Perouse expedition. Back to D'Urville and the Astrolabe. The ship departed Vanikoro on March 17, 1828, half of the crew suffering from fevers and other ailments. Only two of the officers were healthy. Things were so bad, D'Urville considered heading to Australia, but the rains and storms made sailing south nearly impossible. And so D'Urville would make a change of plans. Instead of Australia, he would go with the winds and currents and head northwest towards Guam, a journey of 2,300 miles or 3,700 kilometers. Despite the long voyage ahead of them, the men responded well, knowing that this was the first step in their return home. Little did they know that the journey was going to take them nearly a year. Despite running on a skeleton crew, the Astrolabe reached Guam on May 2nd. It was here that Ferdinand Magellan had landed more than 300 years earlier, making the first ever crossing of the Pacific. The Spanish were sympathetic to D'Urville's situation. An old convent was used as a hospital, and 40-plus men were brought ashore to recover in less cramped quarters and with proper medicine. Some of the men would recover, but not always. The Englishman named Hambleton, who had been added to the crew on the island of Tocopilla, developed severe dysentery and died on May 19th. Despite his murky past, D'Urville lamented the loss of the man. He had been a good sailor and a great help with his language skills. D'Urville had praised the man's intellect. At Guam, the expedition added supplies, including eggs, wine, melons, flour, and fruit. D'Urville was so appreciative of the Spanish aid, he gave the island's governor a portrait he had of Alexander von Humboldt. The governor had met the famed naturalist and admired the man. The astrolabe departed Guam on May 30th and headed southwest, aiming for the Dutch port of Ambon. To demonstrate just how weak and short-handed his crew was, Derville would ask for some men to come aboard the astrolabe to help raise the anchor. The expedition sighted the mountains of New Guinea on June 17th. Derville would like to have explored and collected plant and animal specimens, but he didn't have enough healthy men for such endeavors. He pushed west. By late June, severe dysentery was running through the ship. Two men would die before the month was out. Due to bad weather, the ship would put into the Dutch outpost of Kajili on the island of Baru in the Moluccas. After a short stay, the astrolabe continued on to Ambon. After nearly 2 weeks recuperating in Ambon, Derville accepted an invitation to visit the port of Manado on the southeast tip of the island of Sulawesi. This was a curious decision as it meant backtracking 250 miles or 400 kilometers. Two more of the crew would die while in Manado. Next, the astrolabe was off to Batavia, the Dutch colonial capital, which is modern-day Jakarta. There would be another death along the way. Batavia was a fascinating place, and Derville would, no doubt, have loved to explore the city and the surrounding region, but it was also notorious for being one of the most unhealthy spots in the Far East. The local swamps were breeding grounds for mosquitoes, which meant malaria. The disease killed so many people, Batavia was called the Cemetery of Europeans. Because of this, the astrolabe only stayed in port for 2 days and then continued on to the Javanese port of Anyar. There, the ship took on timber, water, veggies, and other food, including cattle. Next, it was west across the Indian Ocean to Mauritius. Thankfully, the fever and dysentery dropped as the ship went along, although there were two more deaths on this leg of the journey. Another man would die upon reaching Mauritius on September 29th. The astrolabe would spend 7 weeks on the island, getting rotting planks replaced and the ship caulked. Derville would take the time to recover his own health, and he renewed friendships with the locals, including botanist Charles Telfair. The astrolabe departed on November 18th, reaching the island of Bourbon a couple of days later. Here, Derville left several of the chronically sick men, including naturalist Jean-Paul Gaimer and Pierre Laisson, the ship's surgeon. Gaimer would actually end up beating Derville back to France. He would recover and join another ship that stopped on the island. The vessel would avoid many of the stops that the astrolabe had on her agenda and get back to France 2 days earlier. Laisson would return to France as well, but it's not known if he sailed with Gaimer or just came at a later date. Another man left on Bourbon was midshipman Henri Antoine Farragut, who I think I called Farragut in our last episode. Anyhow, he would take a curious path in life. After the departure of the astrolabe, he would catch a ship back to Mauritius. There, he sent in his resignation as a French naval officer. He then married a local woman and spent the next 20 years teaching chemistry and physics on the island. After that, he returned to France. It's suspected that he had met the woman during the long stay on Mauritius and had pretended to be sick on Bourbon so he could go back to be with her. Anyhow, the astrolabe continued her journey and rounded the Cape of Good Hope and stopped in Cape Town. There, the French were entertained by their Dutch hosts. Derville even got to climb Table Mountain with Victor Charles Lotan and naturalist Jean-René Constant-Croix. While in Cape Town, Derville would get a look at another French ship in the harbor, the Zélie. Derville didn't know it at the time, but the ship will be an important part of his future. We will talk about that next time. The astrolabe departed Cape Town on January 2, 1829. The biggest drama of this time was that one of the sailors dropped a heavy object on Derville's foot, effectively crippling him. The ship reached the island of St. Helena on January 15th. Some of the men would go and visit the grave of Napoleon, but Derville passed as he had already done that and his foot was bad. The astrolabe stayed only 2 days before continuing north. After a visit to Ascension Island, the astrolabe continued home. She sailed through the Strait of Gibraltar, and on March 25th, the ship docked in Marseille. Derville had all the important stuff unloaded, specimens, artifacts, logbooks, journals, and so forth, and shipped directly to Paris. He then took the astrolabe to Toulon. The first voyage of the astrolabe was over. Jules Dumont Derville had returned from his first command, and unlike last time, it was a joyous occasion as he was reunited with his family. He had left in 1826 when his son was only 3 weeks old. Now he was 3 years old. Physically, Derville was a weakened man. He was thin and gaunt from malaria, and he would, for the rest of his life, suffer from gout and stomach pains. These issues would make Derville a chronically grumpy man, which is saying a lot considering he was never the most likable person to begin with. Anyhow, the expedition came back and he would get a promotion. By the way, I mentioned a couple of episodes ago that Derville had been promoted to captain after the Coquille expedition. That was wrong. He had been promoted to commander. Now he got the coveted promotion to captain. He would fight with the Naval Ministry for promotions for his men, but it was a frustrating process. Charles Jacquinot, for instance, would not get his promotion until 1836. There would be awards for Derville, but not enough for his tastes. He complained openly about the situation, saying the king, who had not invited him for a formal meeting, and the naval ministry didn't show enough appreciation for what he had done. In fact, there still exists a letter that Derville wrote to the ministry, asking for them to confirm the promotions he had granted, amongst other things. Well, in the margin there's a note written by a ministry official that says, quote, "Monsieur Derville announces that the Astrolabe anchored yesterday at Marseille, and already he is unhappy. That was quick," end quote. Derville would get the privilege of presenting the findings of the expedition to the Académie des Sciences in Paris on May 12th, but later that year his nomination to become a member of the society was met with weak response. This rejection was humiliating. He saw himself as a brilliant man and blamed his rejection as a plot by his detractors. The truth is that while he did some great stuff, so had others. Okay, all of that stuff aside, Derville had returned from his three-year-long voyage, which had been a success. There were tons of specimens, new charts and maps, information on the people they had encountered, and we can't forget the confirmation of the fate of La Pérouse. The latter was a bit late, but still worthwhile. Now, regarding his search for a place for a French colony in Australia or New Zealand, he had found that the former was not really an option due to British movements into the west of the continent. As for New Zealand, he had done some work, but it was incomplete. He had only really surveyed a fraction of the coastline. By the way, the French would ultimately find New Zealand unsuitable for colonization. The warfare amongst the Maori was troublesome, and frankly the English, including traders and missionaries, were becoming entrenched. Trying to set up a colony would, it was decided, invite too much trouble. The French would, however, not give up on their colonial hopes in Asia and the South Pacific. Within the next decade or two, they would control various islands in the South Pacific, including Tahiti. It is why today we have French Polynesia. The French would also conquer Indochina, aka Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, in the late 1850s. Otherwise, people praised Derville and the results of the expedition. However, I want to stress that it wasn't that big of a deal. This was all great stuff, but Derville had not done anything that really struck a chord with the public or the crown. In many ways, he was treading in the steps of other explorers. It was cool, but not that sexy. So that wraps up the first voyage of the Astrolabe. But before I let you go today, I do have an interesting story involving Derville that takes place in 1830. And if you know your French history, that means the July Revolution. The French love their revolutions. Anyhow, Charles X had come to the throne in 1824. He was as reactionary and conservative as you can get. He had done things such as reinstituted the death penalty for sacrilege. He had invaded Algeria, and he had increased the power of the nobility and the church. For 6 years, the discontent of the liberals and republicans grew and grew. Well, in the summer of 1830, Charles issued four proclamations that would light a fire in Paris. These proclamations censored the press, dissolved the newly elected Chamber of Deputies, altered the electoral system, and called for elections under the new system. This infuriated the people, and soon protests began, and it wouldn't take long for everything to get a bit crazy. Now, Derville was in Paris at this time, working on the results of the Astrolabe expedition. As we have talked about, Derville was sympathetic to the Republican cause. He disliked Charles, and he disliked extremism on either side of the political spectrum. However, we don't know the exact role that Derville took in the Revolution of 1830. Some have said that he was in the streets providing support for the Republicans. Others have said that his role was more subdued. To be too active might risk his career. During all of this, Derville would, more than once, go to the Naval Ministry's offices and try and see what he could do to help out the situation. Some might call this political opportunism, but whatever. His attempts to meet with important officials came up empty, until they didn't come up empty. Now, the July Revolution is called the July Revolution for a reason, and that is because it came and went in a matter of days. 3 days, specifically. The riots in Paris began on July 27th, and 3 days later, Charles was effectively done as king. A provisional government was established, and on August 2nd, Charles X abdicated. Louis-Philippe of the House Orléans agreed to rule as a constitutional monarch. He took the crown a week later. It was then that Derville would get called into the naval offices of Jean Toubinier, the nation's director of ports. Toubinier had a mission for Derville: go to the port of Le Havre on the English Channel and escort King Charles into exile. And so Derville made his way to Le Havre, where he found two American ships waiting to take Charles out of the country. He requested that Victor Charles Lottin, who was in Paris at the time, come along as his second-in-command. The request was granted. The ships were then sailed up to the coast of Cherbourg to await Charles's arrival. Gréville then went to wait for Charles, and that took some time. The king didn't want to leave his residence outside Paris until a mob of more than 10,000 approached, intent on finishing him off. And when he went slowly. In his mind, Charles hoped that his allies and the people of France would rally to his cause and insist he take back the crown, but that was not going to happen. The king and his entourage would finally arrive in Cherbourg and prepare to sail on August 16th. The only question was, where? Gréville could take Charles wherever he wanted, except for the following: another French port or territory, Belgium, the Netherlands, or the Channel Islands. Many thought that Charles would go to Naples, where he had family. For this reason, Gréville was prepared to be gone for weeks, even months. The other stipulation was that Charles had to make a decision before he set sail, and there would be no changes once he left port. The destination ultimately given was Portsmouth, England. For Gréville, this was perfect. It was right across the channel. The sooner he was done with this mission, the better. The two ships departed, escorted by a pair of French warships. There were rumors that if Charles' ship tried to go anywhere but England, they would sink it. The voyage across the English Channel would take 24 hours due to difficult weather. Gréville got to meet the former king, and when introduced, Charles reportedly asked if he was the Gréville. He then complimented Gréville on all he had done and expressed his gratitude that such an accomplished officer was leading the mission. Once in England, there were some negotiations with the British government as to the parameters of Charles' exile. In that time, Gréville interacted with the king, his family, and entourage. Charles was ultimately led ashore, but only as a private citizen, not as the head of a government in exile or anything like that. The British wanted nothing to do with the conflict in France. The 73-year-old king thanked Gréville and the crew for their services before debarking. Some members of the royal family would later say that Gréville had been rude towards them and or the king, but that's probably more because he was known to have liberal leanings. And let's be honest, Gréville could seem rude and abrupt to anyone. Why spare the royal family? Anyhow, Gréville deposited his charge in England and headed home. Mission accomplished. Charles, by the way, would never return to France. There were various plots over the years to return his family to the throne, but nothing came of them. He died in Austria, the result of cholera, in 1836. And so Gréville returned to Paris, where he found himself riding high. On September 2nd, he had a meeting with the new king, Louis-Philippe. Gréville was pleased that the king remembered him, as they had sailed together back in 1814, when Louis-Philippe had returned to France after the first abdication of Napoleon. Gréville and his wife would get invited to dinner with the king and 100 others the following Sunday. Another interesting thing that came up were rumors about a movement to bring the body of Napoleon Bonaparte back to France for an official burial. While Gréville was no Bonapartist, he let it be known that he would be happy to do the job. He had actually been to St. Helena, something most of his rivals could not boast. But alas, no luck there, as Napoleon's body would be brought back to France, but not for another decade. Now, all of this seems like Gréville was doing pretty good. He was a successful explorer, he had the attention of his bosses, and he was rubbing elbows with the King of France. But Gréville would quickly sour on the new monarchy, and they on him. He would speak his mind a little bit too often. He would alienate people who could help him. Subtlety was not his strong suit. Heck, the man upset people on a military ship, so you can imagine what he was like around civilians. In the end, Gréville was just not a politician. And so, this is where I will leave things for today. Gréville was home, having successfully concluded a pretty epic voyage. He was a respected naval officer and scientist, but he was no politician, as we have seen. His next few years are going to have him organizing the information from the Astrolabe expedition, not to mention raising a growing family. But if you noticed earlier, I have called this expedition the first voyage of the Astrolabe, and that is because there will be another one. And that's because Jules Dumont Gréville will not be able to help himself. Life will get a bit dull, he will miss the glory and thrill and satisfaction of exploring and command. And thus, like so many before him, including James Cook, he will not be able to resist going on one final voyage of exploration. So that is it for today, the first voyage of the Astrolabe. Next time we will talk about Gréville's life in France in the early 1830s, but more importantly, we will kick off the second voyage of the Astrolabe, which will take us not just around the world, but to the mysterious land of Antarctica. Just saying that makes me shiver. Anyhow, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I will see you next time. The Explorers Podcast is part of the Airwave Media Network. Go to airwavemedia.com to find other cool shows. You know, since we have traveled through the Napoleonic era with Gréville, if you like that sort of thing, there are a couple of shows focused on that period of time. This includes The Age of Napoleon and Gray History.
Hello. My name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.